He's going to be asking for something soon.
I can't start this till he gets back up here.
This is the Joint Committee on Public Safety. Today is March 15th, my goodness, Friday. Today is I'm opening an informational hearing today, meeting, and it's invited testimony today. And while our good senator is passing out these delightful chocolates, we will call up DA John Foote, and I think DA Don Reese is with him, and who else?
Chuck French.
So we have the trio.
So, Madam?
Yes, Senator Roblin.
Thank you. You know, as they're coming up, I just want to say, you know, at the end of the last hearing, I was talking to my good representative to my right, which is where he usually is. And after hearing the great conversations that were going on, it came to me that we have a solution. All of our intake comes through one facility.
Coffee Creek.
And then most of our outtake goes out of one facility. They move people to a place to get them ready, and they have that kind of stuff. And so my consideration after hearing the good stuff that was going on in Clackamas County, that all inmates should leave through Clackamas County. And that we could give them a little extra money to help with their programs, because they're already in place. They have housing. They have all
housing
kinds
and
of
everything.
It could be a real solution to recidivism.
I think you're right. I shared with District Attorney Foote how pleased I was with the results that they're getting in reentry in Clackamas County and the investment that they're making in Clackamas County. So I think you're probably right on target. You know, we should have further conversation and deliberation about that plan. With that, D.A. Foote.
Good afternoon, Chair Winters, member of the committee. My name's John Foote. I'm the D.A. in Clackamas County. And I'll let the other folks on the bench here with me introduce themselves as well.
Good afternoon, Chair Winters, members of the committee. Don Reese, Chief Deputy D.A. from Multnomah County.
Good afternoon, Chair Winters and members of the committee. My name's Chuck French. I formerly, for 31 years, worked for the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and I'm now a policy advisor for Mr. Foote, Mr. Underhill, and Bob Herman in the Washington County District Attorney's Office.
If I could, I just say a couple things, and then we'll kind of take turns walking you through what we have for you today. We've given you some handouts, which we'll talk about during the what we wanted you to have them beforehand. First, I'd like to say, express our appreciation to Mr. Nasby for his assistance in preparing this bill. I actually never sat down and read it till yesterday, even though it came out of our alternative report. We had a lot of good people working on it, and I think it turned out really well, and there are a lot of people to thank, including Mr. Nasby, so I wanted to say that on the record. Thank you. What we intend to do today is kind of walk you through the structure of 3195 and a little bit around it to help explain why we took this approach, and then, of course, answer any questions you might have. So with that, I'll hand it off right now to Don Reese.
Thank you. Chair Winters, members of the committee, I had the opportunity to testify before you previously about prison population forecast, and I don't want to repeat what has already been said, but if I may, just to add a little bit and update a little bit on the view that there's certainly nothing like a crisis facing the state of Oregon when it comes to increasing prison populations. As we noted, historically, the prison population forecast has been wrong and high consistently over time. One of the exhibits we have for you this afternoon is this document showing the historical accuracy of the 10-year prison population forecast, the long-term forecast, as it's called, and We now know, looking back in time over those 10-year periods, that on average, the forecast growth error was 30.8%. More recently, this week, I, as a member of the governor's committee on the prison population forecast, met with Mark McMullen, the state economist, and his staff, who are busily preparing the April prison population forecast. And in the preview of the forecast, we learned that there's no reason to believe there's going to be any significant change from what the state economist is describing as historically modest growth in the prison population. In fact, in another exhibit we have for you, what we are seeing is that the forecast just over the last 6 months since the October forecast is again running high, that the actual numbers is below what was forecast just 6 months ago. And that's significant because as we discussed previously, you understand that in the short term, the forecast is much more likely to be accurate than in the long term, just like the weather forecast. But nonetheless, it's already running high. Notably, the state economist told us that the prison population growth that is forecast is tracking currently with the at-risk population growth in the state of Oregon. That appears to be the most significant driver, increasing population in the state, rather than sentencing policy or crime rate. I think the state economist deserves credit for working on this forecast, trying to make it more accurate. They're still pushing down the curve, but I guess the bottom line message is that prison population growth is not mushrooming. There's not a crisis, and what's forecast is very moderate, measured growth, keeping pace with Oregon's increased population.
Thank you, Chair Winters and members of the committee. Again, my name's Chuck French. I just want to go over, we're going to go point by point through 3195. With that in mind, we believe that this law is tailored, or this proposed law is tailored to the type of growth that we're going to see. We believe it will keep us below the level. We understand the executive branch is trying to set 14,600 inmates by the end of the next biennium. And what we do, what we've done here is we have gone through almost half of these proposals are proposals with which we agree with 3194, which is the bill that was presented and is currently having hearings before your committee. And so let me go through them. Some of these proposals, as you will see, we proposed, and the Commission on Public Safety agreed with. So we are in agreement. There are some disputes about some of the substance of those. But in essence, some of them we completely agree with. Some of them we agree with largely, and certainly in principle. So let me go through and start. And I think what we're going to do is we're going to hand these back and forth, item by item. The first one you'll see is in section one on page. On the first page of this, that's a change in the controlled substance laws. This was proposed by the Oregon District Attorney's Association, and it changes the curve as far as marijuana is concerned. What this is designed to do, because we are incarcerating marijuana manufacturers and dealers at a rate which is based on an offense type that is greater than the federal offense type. So we took a look at this and said, well, we needn't be harsher in our system than the feds are. And so this is designed simply to align our marijuana amounts, with the marijuana amounts that the federal government uses. We know that there are 136 beds in the prison system that are strictly marijuana sales or manufacture defendants or inmates. There are an additional close to 200 beds in which one of those charges is one of the charges is a marijuana offense. Some of those will already have served the time on the other offense, and they will now be only marijuana offenses. So we're dealing with, we believe, it's not significant in terms of the total population of the prison system, but it is significant in terms of our target of what we want to reduce the total beds by. So we're talking, I'm guessing, somewhere over 100 and maybe up to 150 beds, which could be dealt with and no longer go into the prison system if the changes that are proposed here are actually made. So that's section one, and it's kind of long. There are other things that are involved that come across from 3194 that I won't discuss at this point, pertaining to methamphetamine, oxycodone. Those are in the other bill, and nothing's been decided on the amounts of that yet. The second thing is, in this particular section, there is a clause for heroin overdose homicide cases. The federal Len Bias law applies to those things, and Oregon does not have that law currently, and this is simply designed so that we are similar to the federal government in being able to impose a prison sentence for someone who sells heroin, and that results in an overdose death of someone who uses that. So turning to page 5, DWS is another area where we agree with the majority report that came out presenting options from the Public Safety Commission. It's a very simple change, and, you know, I didn't even, Mr. Nasby drafted this, and I looked at it, and I couldn't find anything, any change, until I actually looked very carefully on page 7. What our intent was to reduce the crime seriousness level of felony driving while suspended from 6 to 4. That will be a presumptive probation matter in almost every single instance. So that will effectively, except for someone who has 3 violent felonies, that will effectively reduce to 0 or almost 0 the number of those number of state inmates that are in the state penitentiary for felony driving while suspended charges. So that's another one that we proposed. We understand there are 46 beds that are currently being taken up by inmates with these charges. So between those two, I believe we're talking about somewhere between 150 and 200 prison beds. When you understand what we believe the forecast will show and what we believe the accurate growth for the Oregon State prison system will be, that will, between those two offenses, will keep us below the 14,600 bed limit, which I understand to be the target here. The next proposal is seen on page 7. This is one, again, that we agree with the Commission's major report on. I told Mr. Foote that it looks like I'm going to be doing all the sections where we agree. And it's going to make me look a lot better.
Coincidence, Chair.
We agree with that. The earned discharge for probation, I mean, I think there would be some dispute amongst district attorneys about how much there might be, how much that discharge might be, and whether it's appropriate. But I believe, ultimately, we've come to the conclusion that it's not a bad idea. The problem that I think hasn't been addressed here, and it's really not a problem for us, but it might be a problem for certain community corrections directors. That is that if you understand exactly how they do the community corrections funding, it's based upon a case count. Community corrections will have a certain number of cases of supervisor over which they have supervisory authority, and that will determine each biennium what they're going to be reimbursed for. Now, if we start cutting that, we're dealing with the budget issue there, and we agree with this, but I just think we need to weigh in with the community corrections directors so that they know how this might or might not affect their reimbursement. So essentially, we agree with this one also. Finally, before I turn it over to Mr. Foote, on page 8 is another section which comes out of 1194, essentially, the majority report from the Commission on Public Safety, and it deals with supervision conditions. We agree with the concept of allowing or actually requiring the idea of a risk assessment tool being used. We have a disagreement with the idea that appears in the other bill that judges should not have the authority to set special conditions of probation. That's essentially where we disagree. Otherwise, we agree with this concept. We believe it's appropriate for judges who have to supervise their probationers to at least have the ability to establish a special condition of probation, like don't go into this section of town, don't want you associating with this person and that person, and that should not be left solely to the discretion of the probation officer. We don't have any problem with the probation officers setting special conditions of probation that they seem to be appropriate, but we also think the court should have that authority also. So in essence, we agree with those four concepts here. Those come from, in most part, from the other bill, 3194, that the committee is hearing. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Foote now. I understand the next few measures are some that, like the recidivism measure, that also appears in 3194, but he's going to discuss those bills, or those sections of the bill.
Thank you, Chuck. Chair Winters, a member of the committee, I feel like I'm going over old ground with the folks who are on the commission with me, because we talked about this concept quite a bit, the recidivism concept on page 11, and it does reflect.
John, you need to identify
yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry, John Foote, Clackamas County DA. It does track what I think the best practice is, which is tracking different things, because they show you different. They show you different things, and the three that are identified here are arrest, conviction, and return to prison, which is what the federal government tracks also. And what's very interesting about that 2006 federal study is that when you look at each measurement, you could see how they tracked criminal behavior in different ways, which is very useful. Arrests versus convictions, convictions versus returns to prison, which may not be a conviction. So it tells you different stuff. It's a little more work, but once I think we set it up, I think it would work fine and then help inform us better about what's really going on. Specialty court standards, again, on page 11, we think that's a really good idea, especially in conjunction with a more rigorous approach about what works and what doesn't. We think that makes a lot of sense. So we think the idea of rigorous evaluation and standards kind of go hand in hand, and I'll get to that other point in a minute. That's the number, that's on page 12, program evaluation. This is an area of, as you know, members of the commission, you know this was an area of particular interest to me. Just the reading I've done and the things I've learned over the years about what we think feels good and feels right versus what really changes behavior that would not change otherwise. And it's my personal belief that in this very tight budget climate we live in, that we should only be investing in the second and not in the first, because while it may feel good, it may feel humane, if it doesn't really reduce criminal behavior, it really isn't what we ought to spend our money on. Again, I would say I think we don't give a lot of people enough credit for being able to do things on their own. So I think this is well written, and I think the trick is, how do we set up the culture of making it rigorous enough? Because we would be pushing against kind of some of the culture that we have now, to be frank, and that's very invested in the things that are going now for perfectly legitimate reasons. But I think if we go back and start making the level higher, we'll be better off in the long run, even though it might be painful at first. We'll end up, I think, with fewer programs that what everybody has much more confidence in. So that's a big subject, I think, but that's how I would summarize it. Chuck, did you want to? Oh, and I want to add, using LFO as the base for that independent evaluation, we think, is the right place for it. you might very well agree, since it would be in the legislative branch, but we'd like to take a different approach because this will be a change of culture and put it in LFO rather than the Criminal Justice Commission. And that's in the bill. So, Chuck? Okay, sorry.
Chair Winters, members of the committee, for the record, Don Reese, Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I think if we're still on page 12, section 15 addresses the prison population forecast report and adds some language in sub 3 that should make the forecast more useful and helpful for policymakers, because the intention is to identify the margin of error and probably most notably require the forecast to specify growth based on population growth versus policy or sentencing. Some of these things, the new state economist is, I think, introducing into the forecast and is trying to make these things more clear, but this would make it a matter of law.
I apologize, John Foote, I jumped out of order. That must have been confusing.
Oh, so, all right, I'm going to go to page 12, back to page 12, the fiscal impact statement, and I'll just say what I've said before. This one comes from 3194, and we agree that fiscal impact statement, as it's written here, which I believe is the same way it's in 3194, is an appropriate way to allow policymakers to get a handle on the impacts that that budget or that criminal law decisions have. But the only thing to add is we would want, and perhaps this needs to be clarified, to specifically list the cost of victimization as part of the fiscal impacts of crime changes. Now, I know the Criminal Justice Commission attempts to do that anyway. They in many of their recent reports, they have indicated what the costs to our communities are, and they include victimization, but it wouldn't be a bad idea to make that a legislative necessity.
Chair Winters, John Foote again. Clackamas County District Attorney, I'm on page 13 at the bottom of the page, corrections cost reductions. And this particular section requires the establishment of a task force on corrections cost reductions with various people appointed from various disciplines, staffed by the Department of Corrections. And we think there might be a lot of ways to take on this problem, but we think this is a very irrational one. So we support it, and we think it's a good structure. It takes that out of anybody's hands and puts it in an independent organization or committee to sort of take on this task. And the reason why we think this is important is because, quite frankly, we've had difficulty determining what are the costs. And I've given you two exhibits just to demonstrate this, and I will confess, I don't know which one is right, but I know they're different. And they come from different places. The sources come from different places. And they're both legitimate. This one is the chart that I'm holding in my right hand, is the chart that Department of Corrections presented to Ways and Means. So it comes from the Department of Corrections. And it has Oregon at $30,000 a year, which is about $2,100, $2,200 more than the 21 something, more than the national average. This chart here is from Pew. They did a study they published in June of 2012, therefore the same year, 2009. I understand this came from the American Correctional Association. That's where DOC got it. But this one, Pew published a national study in June of 2012 called Time Served. It came out about 3 weeks before the commission started, but we were never given it. I'll be honest with you, I knew about it, but we were reading so much stuff back then, as you might remember, fellow commission members, that it was hard to keep track. But I've since gone back and read it, and there are there are state-by-state data sheets on it that have the cost per month per inmate for each state. So all we did was take those 34, 35 data sheets and compute the yearly cost and then put it on a chart for you. So it looks like this one, but it doesn't look like this one. They don't look like each other. This source of this information comes from an organization, it's listed in the report by Pew, called the National Association of State Budget Directors, of which Oregon is a member, an active member, and the data for Oregon and every other state comes from that association. So it's not outside, it's straight from Oregon, through that association. So, you know, there's a, we also discovered a study by the Vera Institute and Pew in 2011, which was a study about how corrections departments make it, I'll say make it blurry. They use different language, but about what their costs really are. And there are 40 states in that study. Oregon is not in that study. But the bottom line is, I would say we really don't know what Oregon's costs per day are. And we need to find out. And we have the LFO study, I think, from 2011, which tried to work on it a little bit. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. It talked about a couple of things. But I think we need a broader look. So this task force is to set up an organization to take that task on and not ask anybody to do it right at the moment, because it's a big task. And be glad to answer any questions you have about that. And I do think it's Mr. French's turn again.
We agree. On page 14, the oversight entity section comes from 3194. And again, it's we see no reason to this looks like good public policy. We don't disagree with establishing a task force to study. And the issues the members, there appears to be from 3194 a very broad base of expertise from the criminal justice community, and assuming that that a bill is actually passed out of this legislature, that it would be appropriate to establish an oversight committee such as this to review the progress of that bill as it actually is put into law. So we agree with that, and it comes directly from House Bill 3194.
Chair Winters, John Foote again. And the last item, I think, on the bill is on page 15 and 16. It's called reentry programs. And it sets up a grant program for counties to apply for funding for reentry programs or similar rehabilitation programs it talks about. And we really, what we were thinking here is that we wanted a mechanism by which counties could, if they could make a showing that they had an evidence-based, rigorously evaluated program, get funding for it, and rather than have it being hit or miss. And so that's the concept. And you know, then the question really, I think, is because I think this is very familiar, very kind of similar to what the commission is looking to do. I mean, the commission report, 3194. But we'd like to do it in a little bit more organized way. And then the question becomes, of course, how do you fund this? And we have some ideas about that. And we don't think the way to do it is to simply caps beds, although we understand that that's we want to control prison growth, as we've already demonstrated. But we think there's another way to do it. And it's kind of common sense. And you have in front of you this document, which is a one-page explanation in very kind of simple terms that our problem is really a math problem in terms of population. And it's releases versus intakes. And now when the forecast we're going on now from October predicted we'd have 31 more inmates a month over releases for 3 years. And in fact, right now we're averaging 12 more. That's good news. So if you want to plug 12 into 31, it's the same idea. And we want to invest in the target population that we think is the most easily identified without complicated sentence reform, and that is the population that's failing on supervision. And that is evidently 2,200 inmates or probationers a year. 2,200. So that's 186 a month, I think we figured out the math, and or 183 on the chart, on the sheet. So if we just affect 12, we bend the curve. This is not as big as it sounds in just plain math. So the question is, what are the programs that we think would work? Well, reentry is a program that Criminal Justice Commission studied, and it seems it wasn't a randomized controlled trial, but I've showed it to people that I trust, and they think it looks like a decent study. And it has a proven track record. I mean, the percentage we have to turn of the people who are failing is 17%. We don't have to remake the wheel. We just have to be a little bit more successful than we are now. So where do we get that money? Well, let me close by suggesting this. That there's been so much effort into sentence reform as the way to find money that it has missed the point of what's really going on in Oregon. I just want to read you a couple of numbers about average length of sentences in Oregon versus average length of sentences nationally. And the numbers come from the Bureau of Justice Statistics from 2006. So I use the numbers from Oregon from the Criminal Justice Commission that we just got recently. They published all these numbers from 1995 to now. I picked 2006 to be apples to apples. You can go and look if you want to see what it is in 2012. They aren't radically different. So all crimes, average length of sentencing nationally is 59 months. In Oregon, 34.6. Violent crime nationally, 96 months. Oregon, 46.8. Property crimes in Oregon, 18.1. Nationally, 47. Drug crimes nationally, 50 months. Oregon, 17 point something. In possession, we don't send people to prison for that. And nationally, it's 38 months. And my point here is that we already have very moderate sentences in Oregon. And they are voter approved by and large. And that we don't have to get to the investments we want in the community by gutting those sentences more. We can get there another way. And the obvious elephant in the room is costs. For every dollar a day that we reduce costs in prison, we save $10 million a biennium. So if we reduce the cost per day, if we say to corrections, you're going to get $3.2 a day less per inmate than you're getting now. And they're asking, their budget's built on a 10% increase. So it would still allow them an increase. If we did $3.2 per day per inmate, we would save $32 million, which is what the governor has identified for reinvestment. And if we take that money and we put it into proven programs like the reentry program, you talked, Chair Winters, about Clackamas County. I do think they've made smart investments there. And part of this investment, as you know, has to be by the communities as well as the state. But we could do a lot with $32 million in reentry programs. Or I happen to be a believer in Hope Probation. I think it's a revolutionary idea. But we don't have to decide which programs today. If we set up a way of evaluating them and set the standard high, and we target those investments, we can turn the curve on a prison growth that is already looking very, very modest. So that's really, in essence, the spirit of our effort. We are not trying to prevent investments. We believe in investments. Many of us come from counties where we make those investments. What we want is to not destroy the sentencing system that goes with it that has been so useful for us. The last thing I'd say, and then obviously lots of questions, is we saw on the docket today that somebody from Georgia is coming.
And I would like for us to be kind to our guest.
Oh, I'm not going to say a thing. I've never met them. and it looks like Georgia's done a lot of good things. But everybody starts from a different place. And Georgia started from a very different place than we did. And we thought you would like to see a little bit, so I asked Mr. French if he would just go on the website for their prison reform and produce a short fact sheet. Because I didn't know. And we provided that to you. It's called Applicability of Georgia's 2012 Georgia Public Safety Reform Act to Oregon. And what Mr. French did was try and look at some of the fundamental things they did, not everything by any means, and how that kind of compares to Oregon, so you could see that, you know, in all fairness, we're light years down the road from where they are. Their incarceration rate for violent crime is 47% higher than ours. So kudos to Georgia. Kudos to Georgia.
And I think there's kudos to us. I think we recognize that Oregon has been the leader and that there are members in this room and on that panel who helped to bring us to this place. And I think we've said that all along, you know, through our work in the commission. But I think we also said that we want to continue to be the leader across the state. And we ask ourselves the question, can we actually enhance and do better? So, I mean, it's kudos still to all of us. Oregon is we're very proud of the place that we're in and the work that's been done. And so, and I know that you've been a part of it. I know that D.A. French and others have been a part of where we are today. I need to put that on the record because sometimes we forget to even pat ourselves on the back of the work that we've done in this state. But there's always the question, is there a way that we can always do better? You know, I'm fond of saying that, you know, time changes and we have to be willing to begin changing with time. And we're not the same kid that we were when we were 10, nor will we be the same person we were when we were 30. See, I'm still 30. But that, and a part of that, it forces us to look at where we are today, and it forces us to say that are there things that we can still do, you know, evidence-based, and some of the practices that we had weren't there 30 years ago or 20 years ago. So, you know, as science advances and we learn more, I think we're smart, all of us in this room, of saying let's continue to do better, and let's continue to look at it and see how we can do. So I appreciate, you know, your contribution that you've made to us. You make us think, you know.
Thank you, Chairwoman.
So, and I'm going to open it up for questions. Representative Hicks.
Thank you. And so thank you so much for bringing this bill forward and for the exceptional evidence that you provided to back it up. And so, and in respect for our guests, I'm just going to cut straight to some questions rather than make anything resembling a speech. So could we go to the Len Bias law and the marijuana law that are contained in 3195? There are similar bills pending in, I know, House Judiciary, potentially on the Senate side. And could you just comment, could you possibly comment on similarity here and anything pending in that portion of this process? Could you link those two up or differentiate them, please?
Representative Hicks, members of the committee, I hope they're fundamentally the same because they came from the same place,
exactly.
In my office. But, you know, we want to make sure about that.
Yeah.
We introduced the bills early on. And Representative Gilliam was very helpful to us, and Representative Barker has been very helpful to us. And if they're not exactly the same, we intend for them to be very similar. So I hope they are.
That's helpful.
And we should reconcile them at some point.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 13, recidivism definition.
Mm-hmm.
What does custody mean? Is that at the end of their sort of physical incarceration at Department of Corrections, or is that at the end of the post-prison supervisory period?
Representative Hicks, members of the committee, my guess is that it's the end of their being in custody because it's about being free. And even when somebody's on supervision, they're not completely free, but they're in the community. So my guess is that we start measuring how somebody's doing when they're in the community.
Okay.
So unless somebody thinks differently, that would be my guess of what that definition is, or my preference.
I'll do one more, if I may, and then...
Please.
Thank you. Okay, so final question regarding the Corrections Cost Task Force. We have two sheriffs as members, and I just would just wanted to plant a concept. Maybe I happen to think that maybe a retired corrections officer could help you really mine through what's going on within that organization, possibly. So I just wanted to plant that idea, and we can discuss it offline some other time.
Representative Hicks, we're open to all suggestions. Maybe that could be the citizen person. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to go about it, but we'd be open to that suggestion. Mr. Prince, did you want to add something to custody?
Yes, Representative Hicks and members of the committee, as far as the issue of custody is concerned, the way that section was drafted was so it conforms with the Federal Bureau of Justice Statistics definition, which they've used in two, I think they're considered the seminal studies on recidivism in the country, and they do define it, as Mr. Foote was saying, as when a person gets out of custody.
Okay.
Custody meaning physical custody.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rancher.
Senator Pogranski.
Thanks. Guys, thanks a lot for the presentation. I want to go through a few things that I was hearing and just make sure I got them correct and just make sure I understand. On the first part, Chuck, when we're talking about the acknowledgement of having a controlled substance laws and the DWS, looking at the numbers based on the information we received during the commission, it showed that bed savings there was pretty small in the sense of numbers. But we also understand that the prison growth is still growing. It's increasing. So how do we differentiate between what you're putting on the table for those two sections to actually get us down and not have the growth continue? I know that there's some stuff that was discussed that's not in the bill. Are you suggesting that we start substituting or increase additional things? And if you could just put those on the record as to what those would be.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Przanski and members of the committee. As far as the numbers are concerned, we had a couple different numbers that came out, as I remember them, from the commission. The first number was about 200 beds. The second number, it was down to 100 beds for those two measures. I'm not sure what the figure is and how the methodology was used to determine that. So we went back to the Department of Corrections to figure out how many people are actually in custody for those offenses. And I was told by Director Peters, I think, who sent an email to Mr. Foote, there were 136 marijuana beds who were being used strictly for marijuana and close to 200 others in which that was one of the charges. So there's a fair amount of beds to work with there. The felony DWS is a lot smaller at 46, so we're not talking about a lot of beds. But when we are talking about the numbers here, the current the October prison forecast suggested that by the end of the biennium there would be about close to 15,300 inmates in the state prison system. We had skepticism about that, and it's turning out, at least up to now, as Mr. Reese had said, that the forecast is about half or a little bit less than half in the first 5 months of what was predicted. So we believe the actual growth, if that's a measure of what's actually going to happen, will be somewhere in the neighborhood of, without any changes, 14.7, 14.8. We believe that a combination of these two measures would bring it down about to the 14,600. I mean, we want to try to hit that target if we can. And so just with those two offenses, changing the law on those offenses, we believe it's going to essentially hit what I understand to be Governor Kitzhaber's goal. The other thing, and it's a little bit harder to quantify, is the program that Mr. Foote described about reentry and treating inmates who are released from the prison system in an intensive reentry program. During the first commission hearings, the Criminal Justice Commission was represented by Mike Wilson, who came and testified about the program that Mr. Foote referred to, that it had a 29% reduction in recidivism at the felony level for those who entered those programs, which cost about $3,400 an inmate. So we believe that investment in that type of program, without going through all the numbers, is going to cut away. How much is going to cut away, we don't really know. But it is a type of evidence-based program that that we are increasingly turning to.
And so that's another, it's not going to go the other direction. So if we've brought it down to 14,600, we're not going to increase the recidivism rate of people released from prison. We'll only improve it. And so how many that is, I don't know that we can say that specifically, but it will be a number that will reduce it even further. Mr. Foote, did you?
Could I add just one thing to that? Senator Prusansky, members of the commission, members of the committee, excuse me. I also, and I'm only speaking for myself here, but when I heard the number 136 people in prison for this, who I'm willing to talk about myself, and I'd have to ask my colleagues about retroactive. We don't have the same problems that we do with victim crimes. We don't have the same challenge with either of these crimes. Potentially, I'm not. It takes some looking into. But if we really wanted to save some beds, we have had conversations privately about whether we'd be willing to entertain that conversation. I think we would, which would increase the impact of any savings. So I just throw that out for you to think about. Our aversion to the prior retroactivity, but this is different. And we're willing to talk about it. So I want to throw that out.
Follow up with a couple other things. The cost per day. We know that the vast majority of our cost in our prison system is labor. Are you talking about somehow renegotiating or doing away with the type of labor pool that we use now as to, I'm not sure, because it's like 3/4 of the cost per day is the labor. How are we going to address that?
Senator Prusansky, members of the committee. I have been a public employee most of my life, and I believe in public employees. I was in the Department of Corrections for 5 years, long time ago, but my bet is it's still mostly staffed with the same kind of people that when I was there, and they're pretty good people, and they do a very difficult job, and I do not believe in underpaying people, whether it's in the Department of Corrections or in the DA's office or anywhere else. I'm a supporter of public employees. I also believe that we just have challenges, and we all have to join in the solutions. And I don't know how we get there. What I do know is that I don't think we have our arms around this. I don't think we've taken it on, and we need to. We need to put pressure on costs. How we do that has to be a combination of things. Everybody has to get in the game, and we have to stay in the game. We can't just say that the only answer is letting people out. That's, in my opinion, not doing what we're supposed to do. So does it involve that conversation? Yes. I will tell you, at my office, our prosecutors voluntarily for 2 years had their COLAs and merit increases suspended during the heart of the recession, which saved jobs. So this is a shared problem, and it's a shared solution. And I don't think we need to scapegoat anybody, and I don't think we need to beat anybody up. But we need to get straight about this. This is just me talking. And put it on the table and not draw any assumptions before we really do the work.
Okay.
You know, let's just say we did $32 million. The corrections budget is $1.4 billion. That's a huge budget. I mean, $32 million sounds like a lot of money. But, I mean, there is room there for a conversation, I think.
Let me ask on the issue about 30 in, 30 out, as we're talking about. To me, when I look at that, the number is, I'm not sure how we get there in the sense of, I understand 30, but it doesn't seem like it factors in the length of stay and who's coming in and how long they're going to be there as to how you say which are you going to be letting out on 1 month versus the next month based on the likelihood of who's coming in, what the length of their sentence is. Is there some type of...
I always like to, Senator Prusansky, members, I always like to defer to Mr. French because he's the one who knows all the numbers. But I will suggest this, and also Mr. Reese, who's on the forecasting committee and is much more intimately involved than I am. So I will defer whatever details to them. But when you look at the factor right now, we're at 12 a day, and you look at the... And that's statewide, 12 a month, and that's statewide. There's plenty of room to make this work. It's just not that big. Once we stop overestimating the growth. So, and you combine it with these reasonable sentencing changes and the fact that we already have recent reasonable sentencing in Oregon, and then make the investments in some programs, I think this is just very doable. And if it's, I do think that length of stay is factored into these numbers because that's the way the forecast is built. As you know, the forecast is built on a very complicated, way complicated, as far as I'm concerned, factoring length of stay, all sorts of things. So I think the forecasters would have to actually say, and I know Mr. Harcourt just stepped up, and he has actually talked to the forecasters about this, but the forecast itself is premised and woven into length of stay. So my guess is whatever margin there is so small, combined with the fact we have so much margin to make this work, that that this is very doable.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Prezansky and members of the committee, Mr. Harcourt, who really has done the lion's work on this, just did show me what is the last forecast. And I think it really is as simple as that. If you have 20 intakes every month and 20 people are released every month, your population will remain the same. The first paragraph of the forecast says, the inmate forecast uses a model which simulates inmates entering prison, their length of stay in prison, and final release. The primary driver of the forecast in the short term is the release rate of existing prison population. In the long term, new intakes drive population. The rate of intakes and releases results in a turnover of about half the inmate population every year. The forecast model uses intakes and releases, and if you view it from on a month-to-month basis, and I sat through half of the inmate forecast hearing last Tuesday, I believe it was, down here in Salem, that's what they're talking about. They're producing graphs after graphs after graphs of what does the inmate intake profile look like every month, what does it look like for inmates being released. And so if you obviously if you have 14,300 inmates in the prison system, I think it's now 14,308. If you have 14,308 inmates and you get 200 inmates this month and you release 200 inmates by the end of the month, you will still have 14,308. And I know that's where Mr. Harcourt has come from in that analysis. What can we do to see to it that what in the past has been an excess number of admits is now equaled out to the same, so we have the same number of admissions every month as we have releases. And it really is that simple mathematically.
Let me follow up with one other question.
Go ahead.
And I guess this is the one that's probably a little bit more puzzling. Chuck, in your presentation, what I heard was that under the proposals that are there, 3194, the specialty courts, that y'all were okay with them in concept. And then, John, you've also said that you support and believe that we should be moving toward that what I'm going to call the HOPE probation program. We have a bill that's in front of us, Senate Bill 69, that deals with the Multnomah County's DISP program, which is the DUII court, shows and has all the similarities, if not exactly the same as the HOPE project. But ODA has taken the position of opposing it. And I'm kind of trying to figure out where you have a program that meets the HOPE probation, you would like these specialty courts, but we're basically saying no to this opportunity to actually use a program that's actually gone through the rigor, has actually demonstrated a recidivism rate of like 10% after 3 years. I'm not sure what, if I'm hearing you correctly, as to does this not make a good example of why we should be supporting a program like that, since it does meet that criteria?
Senator Prezansky, members of the committee, that's a very interesting question. And as you were asking it, I was thinking about HOPE and how complicated that concept is and how the people who did the evaluation in California, the two-year randomized controlled trial, Dr. Hawken and others down at Pepperdine, and how I've talked to them at length about how they feel there are certain key trigger points in HOPE that have to be done. And there are programs around the country who have parts of it and parts that don't. So when I compare HOPE to something else, I want to be very careful because it is all about the details. And I don't know DIS. But I think what's going on with DIS is, first of all, it hasn't been randomized controlled trial tested. So we know the people coming out seem to be doing well, but we don't know whether it's the program. And I know that sounds technical, but I think it's fundamental to understanding really how we look at programs. Just because people do well in them doesn't mean it's the program. It might be just be picking people who are ready for change. And that's what a randomized control really does the best job of isolating. And I also think the other thing about DIS that I understand is it's, and I've talked to Judge Alm a great deal in Hawaii about what goes on there and kind of the context for hope for him as a former prosecutor. And he doesn't do hope in lieu of proportional punishment. He does hope in addition to proportional punishment. And my view of DUIIs, and I think most prosecutors, is that we do so little proportional punishment of DUIIs, even with all the efforts in the last few years. I will tell you, in my county, and I bet we're similar, a third DUII, which can be a fourth with diversion, will get you a few weeks in jail with probably an ankle bracelet or release before then because of crowding. So there's already this tremendous shortcoming about proportional punishment in DUIIs. And we had Measure 73, which no DA wrote, but was an attempt to sort of do a little bit more with that. And then it got changed in the legislature to 90 days, which I think everyone was okay with. But I think if you put it in that context, there's this sense that we're watering it down again. And so that's pushing against this other. And what we're trying to do is figure out the right balance. And we feel like this bill is not the right balance. All due respect to Judge Daly, hard work she's doing and her passion for this. So it is complicated. I think we ought to sit down and look at it. Hope is a drug testing program, and DIS is a DUII. So they are different. Well, and Hope tests everybody every week. I don't know what DIS does. So I think we'd have to, I'm not the right one to answer that question.
I would encourage you to check with your colleagues in Multnomah County, because my understanding that the district attorneys actually does support the program. The findings mm-hmm. have been reviewed. They've got results. And what I know of the Hope Project, they hold these individuals accountable. They have people in front of the judge within a very short period of time, just like they do in Hawaii. And it seems to me it's very similar. So I'd like for you to look at that, because it seems to me if we're really saying we want to talk the talk, let's walk the walk as it pertains to specialty courts and programs that actually meet or surpass what the Hope Project is. Thank you.
Thanks.
I only have one point of clarification, Mr. French, and that is on the 200 in, 200 out. Does that presuppose or assumes that the sentencing is the same? Because I'm trying to figure out if you've got 200 coming in and 200 going out, if the sentencing and the length is not the same, how then do you reconcile that? Because in your system, we don't always have 200 coming in and 200 coming out on a consistent basis.
Senator Winters and members of the committee, or Chair Winters.
I just need help with
that. Senator, Chair Winters and members of the committee. I do believe that the equation is as simple as it's been described, because every month a certain number of inmates come in and every month a certain number of inmates go out. And if you equalize those, you're going to have no prison growth at all. Now, I understand your position that the sentence lengths will be different. Sentencing laws may change. They may change in both directions. District attorneys' decisions about and defense attorneys' decisions about how cases are resolved and at what level they're resolved may well change. But that doesn't change the fundamental mathematical equation that if you equalize the same number of if you equalize your admissions to prison with your releases from prison, you won't have any growth. Now, we know what the admissions profile looks like now. We know sort of what the release profile looks like. I saw a graph presented, or a number of graphs presented, on release profiles of inmates at the committee meeting on prison forecasting on Tuesday, and they're very, very confident that they know what the release profile of all the inmates who are currently in the Oregon State prisons are. So they know how many people are going to be released, when they're going to be released, and within a few months, whether they get good time or don't get good time, when each of those are going to be released. The question is, what is the profile of people who are being admitted? And the issue to know whether we're going to have more admissions or less admissions in the course of the future years. And historically, as Mr. Reese has pointed out, those the analysis that has been used has always produced a forecast that has been high. We feel like the forecast that was produced in October was high, and I think the figures are bearing that out. And it's simply a matter of not as many. They know who's being released. They know what that profile looks like. The people who are being admitted are not quite what they were expecting in October. And so it's once again replicating what has happened in the past. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, a lot hinges on what happens on the front end and what the crime is committed. It happens also, we've got 36 district attorneys in 36 counties, and it also depends upon what, you know, comes out of those. That, because, as I said earlier, the input going in and the output coming out, that DOC has no control over either, really. And so, because that input coming in is based on what's occurring in the communities, the charges that are occurring in the communities, the sentencing that takes place in the communities, that then says, DOC, it's your responsibility from here on until time for them to be released. And that's why I'm trying to frame in my own mind, you know, when you start talking about this balancing, and you can have input and output that says 200, 200. I'll work on it, though.
Okay.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
With that, I would like to, do you have a question? No. Okay. We have a guest with us today from Representative Jay Neal. If you would come up. And thank you for coming all the way from Georgia to be with us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
And if you would state your name for the record. And
I'm State Representative Jay Neal from Northwest Georgia.
Lafayette?
Yes, ma'am. We don't say Lafayette,
oh, okay.
We say Lafayette there.
Oh, Lafayette.
But that is the way it's spelled.
Oh, okay. Probably can get some
Louisiana.
Good gumbo there, too. Yeah.
Louisiana.
That's Louisiana. But you got peaches here?
We do have plenty of peaches. And
I'll get it right.
And I would say pecans, but probably pecans.
Pecans, depend on the part of the state. I would say pecans.
Yeah.
In South Georgia, where the farmers are, they call them pecans.
Well, welcome to Oregon.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be with you today.
And we know that Georgia has gone through some of the similar processes that we're going through now, and we'd like for you to share with us in your own words of and help us through this.
Yes, ma'am. If it's okay, I'll tell you a little bit about myself first. I am serving in my fifth term, beginning my ninth year as a state representative. My background prior to being a state representative, and I continue to preach, but I pastored for 25 years. I come from a family that is a family of very conservative religious background, and based on that, the belief systems that I developed growing up and took into adulthood, I had some very strong feelings and opinions about addiction and about the behaviors of people that were bound by addiction and alcoholism. And when I ran for state representative in 2002, by the way, I won in 2002, and a judge overturned that based on a lawsuit filed by my opponent, and I had to have a couple of special elections in 2003 before finally winning in 2004 and having the opportunity to serve. But one of the things that I campaigned on was working to keep our communities safe. I feel like that's a very important part of our responsibility as legislators and community leaders. And it was one of the primary components of my campaign. And to me, what that meant was that I would make sure that we did everything we could to hold offenders accountable. And if they were not able to straighten up, that we probably didn't have them in there long enough and needed to increase their time and keep them in prison a little bit longer. And that was the background behind my experience coming in as a state representative. My only experience with people with addiction and alcohol issues as a pastor was trying to relate to those families, the specifically mothers and children of the alcoholics and addicts that were not taking care of their families. They didn't hold down a job. They didn't take care of the needs at home. And I felt, very frankly, that they were neglecting. And if they love their parents or their family more, they'd do a better job. And if they can't do it on their own, we'll teach them lessons and lock them up. It was during the course of a campaign that I found out the incumbent that I was running against was going to tackle the meth epidemic in our area. And while you're talking about things from our area, peaches and pecan and meth, probably all three go hand in hand there in northwest Georgia mountains. We were one of the hubs of the meth epidemic back in the early 2000s. And in response to the position that I found out he was about to take, I began to take my position on what I was going to do to address the meth epidemic in northwest Georgia, specifically, but Georgia as a whole. And when I was elected, I introduced legislation to that end. And the legislation that I introduced in 2005 reduced the number of meth labs by 65% in the state of Georgia in the first year, and was modeled by several states as well. During the time that I was working that piece of legislation, I was working with the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse and other organizations there in Georgia that had an interest in drugs and the meth epidemic and recovery. And also a man who was opening a recovery residence in my town had approached me during the campaign about serving on the board. He was going to open this recovery residence. And I agreed to do that primarily for political purposes, just to be honest with you. And it was during that session that I was pushing the meth epidemic that the men in that program began to attend my church. And what I saw from those men in that program was totally different from everything that I believed about addiction and about addicts and alcoholics. I saw men who were broken because of their failures, men who cried. I talked with them as they literally cried because of the way they had failed their wives and the way they had failed their children. And quite frankly, I had a hard time balancing what I had always believed with what I was now experiencing with these men in my congregation. As we wound down that session, and I was still trying to balance out what I had always believed, and by the way, Georgia as a whole believed that as well. We were very strong state in punishing people who got out of line. And as I was trying to balance that out, I was invited to attend a Science of Addiction seminar. And I went to this Science of Addiction seminar, and I began to see what neurologists have learned about addiction and what they've learned about the chemical changes of the brain based on those substances that are introduced to the brain. And for the first time, I was able to begin to realize what was happening in the lives of those addicts and alcoholics. And it wasn't that they were just not concerned about their families. It wasn't that they were just continuing to make bad choices. They had made some bad choices and introduced their brains to these substances that had literally changed the makeup of their brain. And I began to realize that it would be impossible for us to punish away an impacted brain like that. You can't punish a disease away. And I began to realize that that there were other options that would be more effective in dealing with those addicts and alcoholics. I became the voice for recovery and the voice for addiction services in the state of Georgia. And for the next 4 or 5 years, that was basically the thing that I did the most. Now, I was the go-to, still am the go-to guy for the GBI, Georgia Bureau of Investigation. I've introduced a number of pieces of legislation dealing with DNA and closing loopholes. And people look at the initiatives that I've been involved in, and it kind of puzzles them sometimes because it looks like I'm on both sides. And it's because I try to do what's right. I try to do the right thing. It was 3 years ago that I was introduced to science or to evidence-based sentencing and correction. I came back home with the commitment that I would be the voice of criminal justice reform. I called my chief judge and took him out to lunch right after, shortly after, and we sat down, and over lunch I began talking to him about my vision for criminal justice reform, and I was relating to the experiences that I'd had and the things that I'd learned over the last 5 years leading up to that time working with addicts and alcoholics, and realizing that there's a huge difference between people who have a criminal mindset and people who are behaving criminally because of addiction. Realizing there's a huge difference between those who we're mad at and those who we're afraid of. And in Georgia, we were institutionalizing, we were incarcerating people who didn't have a criminal mindset, but rather were involved in addiction-driven crime, whether it was shoplifting and petty theft or whatever it was that they were doing to support their habit. We were incarcerating a lot of people that we were mad at and should have been trying to help them, rather than just the ones that we're afraid of and needed to be protected from. So as I began to share with him what I envisioned us doing in the state of Georgia, he folded his hands and leaned over the table, and he said, "Representative, if I were you, I would I'd stay away from that topic. I wouldn't go there." And I said, "With all due respect, Your Honor, why should I not do that?" And he said, "It's politically risky. It's politically risky." I didn't run for state representative because I had ambitions or I was seeking power or I wanted to climb any kind of ladders. I ran for state representative because some folks in my community had contacted me, asked me to run, and all they could get out of me was agreeing that I'd pray about it. After a serious prayer and consideration, my wife and family and my church believed that for some reason God was wanting me to run. By now, I had known. It had been made clear to me why I was supposed to run, and that was so that I could make a difference in my state, make a difference in these families that were broken by generational cycles of addiction and generational cycles of crime. And if I could do something to impact those families and to impact the culture in the state of Georgia, that was why I believed that I was there. And I respectfully told the judge, "I'm in a safe Republican district. My district votes about 70%. I was well-liked in my district. I could make sure that I don't make any waves, and I could probably be a state representative as long as I wanted to. And if I didn't do what I was sent down there to do, I would still be a failure. And if somebody somehow spends a lot of money and convinces people that my efforts indicated I was soft on crime and my terms are shortened by a term or two, but I've done what I needed to do to change the culture in Georgia and give lives back to families, then I could walk away from that knowing that I had done exactly what God called me to do and exactly what I wanted to do as a state representative to impact my state." So I took it upon myself to work with the group that came back and begin some meetings to figure out what we could do to begin and initiate criminal justice reform in the state of Georgia. I didn't know at that time that my congressman, who was running for governor, and I was supporting, but I didn't know at that time he had a similar interest. He wasn't talking about it on the campaign trail. We'd never had any personal conversations. But once he was elected, I sat down with him in his transition office. We already had the speaker and the lieutenant governor sign off on a letter indicating our commitment to criminal justice reform. I sat down with Governor Deal and shared with him what we had been meeting about over the course of the last 6 months, and that we'd appreciate it if he would consider signing this letter of commitment to pursuing criminal justice reform. And he began sharing with me his vision. And it sounded like he'd been in those meetings that we'd been having up to that point. He had the same vision we did. So in 2010, I introduced House Resolution 265 establishing the Criminal Justice Reform Council for Georgians. We had a press conference with the governor, speaker of the House, lieutenant governor, and the chief justice announcing that this initiative was being introduced, and the council went to work. Over the course of about 6 months in 2010, the council put together their recommendations for the criminal justice reform effort to move forward. I will say to you that throughout that effort, we had some opposition from a number of individuals that, quite frankly, didn't understand some of what we were trying to do. The district attorney just a few minutes ago mentioned in his testimony that, and I don't remember the exact quote, but he mentioned something about changing culture. Well, we're trying to change culture, and it's not an easy thing when you try to change culture. Georgia, for the last 40 years, have been building prisons. Prisons in South Georgia was an economic development opportunity, and as a state senator or state representative, if you could get a prison in your district, you were bringing jobs to your constituency. So we built a lot of prisons in Georgia over the course of those few decades, and we filled them up, and we were doing a good job of filling them up. So it was quite a change of culture when we started talking about criminal justice reform. We had on that council, we had three senators and three state representatives, three Superior Court judges, and four people appointed by the governor. One of those four individuals appointed by the governor was a district attorney who I had, quite frankly, asked the governor not to put on that criminal justice reform council because he was a very outspoken, larger-than-life opponent of what we were doing, and I knew that he would be. So when the criminal justice report came out in the fall of 2000 or December of 2011, there was an addendum to that criminal justice reform council report put on it by the district attorney who was in opposition to much of what the council had indicated would be good for Georgians. We began to move forward in 2012, taking the recommendations of the criminal justice council report, and I encouraged the governor, let's put it all in there. Everything the council recommended, let's put it all in the bill. Instead, we ended up shying away from a couple of things, specifically that the district attorney was very strongly opposed to. We ended up shying away from a few of those things, and we went for a little bit lesser bill. It was still a significant bill. We addressed a number of things. We were looking at a growing prison population that would cost us $264 million over the next 5 years. We were able to pass a criminal justice reform package that flatlined that growth. We did a number of things dealing with felony levels for property crimes, check fraud, shoplifting. In Georgia, we had one burglary. It didn't matter whether it was a shed or whether it was a residence. It was burglary, and it had the same sentencing range. So we broke that down to first and second degree to identify the level of burglary, and we changed some of those sentences. We took our drug possession. Instead of having one drug possession, we broke it down by weight, and we changed the sentencing for those based on weights. There were a number of things that we did. We really looked strong at some community based opportunities. We put $12 million new into accountability courts. We took our state level of funding to accountability courts from $2 million we put $10 million. We went from $2 million to over $12 million in state funding for accountability courts. We put $5 million into juvenile justice this year. We're being able to put some of that money into community-based programs so that we can get better results. One of the things that I when I'm talking about criminal justice reform, one of the comparisons that I use or analogies that I use is what we've been doing in Georgia is the most expensive form of treating, especially that low-level offender, those that we're mad at rather than those we're afraid of. We're treating them the most expensive way that we possibly can in the state of Georgia by incarcerating them. And I relate to a story when I first went to the store after I was married and bought milk for my wife, and I brought it back, and it wasn't Mayfield milk. It was the store brand. And she said, that's not Mayfield. And I said, Mayfield's a lot more expensive than this. And she said, I know it's more expensive, but it tastes better. Well, I started buying Mayfield milk because it tasted better. It's more expensive, but it tasted better. Could you imagine if she had tried to tell me, I know it's more expensive, but it doesn't taste as good? Well, in Georgia, what we've been doing with the way we handle offenders is we've been doing the most expensive way. And it would be one thing if we could say, I know it's more expensive, but it's more effective. But we couldn't say that because the data shows, the evidence shows that it's more expensive and less effective when you take these nonviolent, these low-level, these non-criminally minded individuals and you use incarceration for their means of treatment or their means of accountability. Too many times we've seen these individuals go into the prison system without a criminal mindset and they come out with a criminal mindset. We see them come out with a felony on their record and they're more dangerous. If we want to protect public safety, and I think I've done a good job of that as a state representative, I've just done it from a little bit different angle than I thought I would. If we want to protect public safety, we want to make sure we don't take these offenders that are not criminally minded. We want to make sure we don't put them in the prison to make real criminals out of them so we can turn them back loose in the community as a real threat. And the reality is most of them are coming back out. Most of them are coming back out. When we can intervene on a community level through our accountability courts, through our day reporting centers, through probation, many other things that we've done to intervene on a community level, and we can provide the services that we need, still holding them accountable, still hold them accountable for their offenses, still hold them accountable for their activities, but we do it in a way that we're able to provide the treatment for them that allows them to overcome their addictions. When they overcome their addictions, the criminal activity goes away for these offenders. So we've looked at ways, even for those who are utilizing petty thefts and shoplifting and check frauds and those type of individuals, burglaries, and they're doing it just to support their crimes or just to support their habits, rather. When we can take those individuals and treat them, those criminal behaviors go away, far more effective, far less expensive. We went through the process for criminal justice reform, and we had opposition right up to the very end. As a matter of fact, 2 days before we took the vote on the House floor for our criminal justice reform bill, the president of the Sheriff's Association sent out a blistering letter to everybody in his county and to every sheriff in the state of Georgia and to every newspaper in the state of Georgia, talking about how there were going to be blood on the streets as a result of our efforts in criminal justice reform, attacking us in every effort and every way that he could. The district attorneys fought us to the very end. The county commissioners were saying to the very end that all you're doing is trying to shift the cost from the state to the county level. We persevered. We did what was right based on the evidence and the data, knowing that we were making the right decisions for the state of Georgia. And we passed our criminal justice reform out of the House with a vote of 162-0. It went to the Senate and passed in the Senate with a vote of 51-0. I can tell you this, the larger-than-life DA that opposed so much of it throughout the process, when we had the press conference for the governor's signing of the criminal justice reform, he was the one that was standing over the governor's left shoulder at the press conference when that criminal justice reform bill was signed into law. The governor expanded our criminal justice reform. My bill only set it up for 1 year. He, by executive order, expanded the council. He added new members to it, a few new members to it, and he expanded the charge. He said, we want to take a deeper look at adult criminal justice reform, and we want to look at juvenile justice reform. We went after the hard things this year in our adult criminal justice reform. The things that we left on the table, the mandatory minimums, even going after our seven deadly sins and the mandatory minimums on seven deadly sins, those issues that we chose not to address last year because of the strong opposition from the district attorney, those were part of our criminal justice reform package that we moved through this year. It also passed the House with a unanimous vote. Our juvenile justice reform measure, which went through the House this year, removed the mandatory minimums on juveniles for everything, including the seven deadlies. We reduced our ceilings on our sentences for juveniles by more than 50% in most cases. We're directing $5 million into community-based programming for districts that are able to reduce the number of juveniles that they're sending to institutions and handling them in the community. We put $5 million in incentives for those. That bill also passed unanimously out of the House. And in the Senate, they both passed out of the Senate on Wednesday. We are in recess today, and we'll be in recess Monday and Tuesday. It is my belief that we'll see the criminal justice reform and juvenile justice reform passed out of the Senate by what I believe will be a unanimous vote by the end of next week. A state that was very much, as we began moving the criminal justice reform, it was very much a change of culture for our state. But we did a few things that I think are critical. We looked at the data. We looked at the evidence. We looked at the outcomes. And we decided that we were going to do what was right for Georgia and what was right for Georgians. And we faced some opposition along the way, but we moved forward. And I'll tell you this, by the way, when we moved the adult criminal justice and the juvenile criminal justice out this year with those issues, the district attorneys were right there supporting it all the way, speaking in behalf of it in committee as we moved it out this way. The sheriffs that were concerned that we were going to fill up their jails, now, as of today, 78% of the beds in our county jails are filled. 22% of the beds in our county jails are empty today. The county commissioners that were afraid we were going to be pushing the cost down to them have seen no added cost. We're seeing some incredible things happening as a result of this criminal justice reform. And probably more importantly than all, we passed this going into an election cycle. And there were a lot of people that were a little bit concerned about passing something like this going into election. And I drew primary opposition. And people would have believed or assumed that as a Republican, I was probably drawing that primary opposition because of the stance that I took on criminal justice reform. But criminal justice reform was so well received by the public that the only time criminal justice reform came up in my campaign, it was for one reason, to say that I was trying to take more credit than I deserved for what happened in criminal justice reform. It wasn't negative at all. My opponent said, I know that Representative Neal is going to say that he was one of the leaders in criminal justice reform, and he was. And he's going to tell you that it passed unanimously, and he did. But what you need to understand is this was a bipartisan effort. That was the response that I got to it, and it's been good for Georgia. It'll be good for Georgia going forward. And I appreciate the opportunity to come and share a little bit about our story, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Olson.
Thank you. Jay, hey, thanks for being here. Could you just touch a little bit more on the reforms that you've done with juveniles?
We have, with our juvenile justice reform, we are looking at based on the evidence, it's pretty evident that the best way to treat these juveniles is to keep them as close to the community as you can rather than institutionalize them. And some of these juveniles need to be institutionalized. We need to be protected from them. But we need to make sure that that those who are not a threat in their communities are not put in the juvenile detention centers where they'll be further corrupted when they can have the services close to home. So we have removed those mandatory minimums on everything, including the seven deadlies in the state of Georgia. We are incentivizing our local communities to provide more services within the community. The governor in the budget proposal this year recommended $5 million to do that. That has passed the House. It's now in the Senate. The budget is now in the Senate. We believe that the Senate will say yes to that as well, and that $5 million will go into the juvenile justice. We're trying to incentivize. We've got a few juvenile courts that are doing it right. They're doing some incredible things. Judge Teske in Clayton County is known across the country for some of the things that he's doing with juvenile justice, and we're trying to make sure that we have more of our juvenile courts across the state that are handling those juveniles in those type of local settings rather than forcing them into the institutions.
Thank you.
Senator Pogranski.
Thank you. Representative Hill, again, thank you very much for coming up on your recess. Can you kind of just for the record, seven deadlies, kind of give us what perspective, what type of crimes you're talking about that was included in that?
The seven deadlies in Georgia, murder, rape, aggravated assault, armed robbery.
Kidnapping, aggravated sexual
battery.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yep.
Molestation. aggravated child molestation.
Those are, and those were believed to be untouchable. Those were believed to be untouchable. When we started criminal justice reform, one of the things, when we first started it, one of the things that we talked about initially is, we're not talking about the seven deadlies, okay? I understand that. We're not talking about the seven deadlies. And we didn't in the first year. But as we began to move forward and see the successes that we were having and recognizing the need of addressing some of those, the seven deadlies became a part of the conversation this year.
If I can follow up. And that's not just in the juvenile, but also in the adult system.
That's correct.
And then you've mentioned incentivizing the system. One of the things that we're looking at is what we're calling reinvesting at the community level. And it sounds like that's what you're referring to.
Absolutely.
So did you actually have to, let's say, pass the sentencing reform modifications that you did to actually, let's say, at least get the starting of reinvesting money? In other words, I know now that everyone's on board, and so they're now focusing, diverting more money to it. But when you started this, did you take the savings from your state system to get it down at the county level?
The difficult thing is, with a measure like this, the difficult thing is, You don't recognize those savings on day one. You recognize those savings as you progress. So in Georgia, we were committed enough to moving forward with this that we worked hard in the budgeting process, and we found ways to invest in those areas, knowing the savings that we were going to receive from it. So we stepped up and put it in on the front end. We anticipate, as we move forward and begin to realize those savings, we anticipate increasing those incentives to the communities, increasing incentives to accountability courts. There's no question that accountability courts and our day reporting centers and those types of community-based programs for adults, and then the community treatment for our juveniles has to be a part of what we're doing moving forward. If we approach this, and I think this is important, if we approach this just as a cost-saving measure, thinking that we can do this to save money, and then, oh, by the way, we'll take some of the savings to put in the community, we'll not have the success we need. This is a public safety-driven approach that has the added value of saving money that allows you to invest into the community. There's no question that when you provide the right sentencing and the right level of corrections and the right level of treatment for these offenders, there's no question that it becomes a public safety initiative, probably even more so than a money-saving initiative.
One last one.
Found one.
So, Representative Neal, again, from what I heard in your testimony, it sounds to me outcomes as to what is delivered through this process is what drove the Georgian legislature to actually take that step, knowing that you could, reduce recidivism, make your community safer based on the outcomes and evidence-based programs?
Absolutely. And some of what we did in criminal justice reform is we required standards to be set up for our accountability courts because there were no real good standards, and we had some, quite frankly, good accountability courts, and we had one or two that probably were doing more harm than good. And especially when you have accountability courts that are taking the really low-level offenders that probably they don't even need to be an accountability court. They just need a little community supervision and a little bit of community treatment, and you bring them into accountability court, you actually increase their risk of recidivism. Accountability courts are more effective for the medium and high-risk offenders than they are those very low-risk. So we established standards for our accountability courts. We are requiring data collections on those, and we're looking at measured outcomes. And the accountability courts apply for grants on an annual basis, and part of that grant application is the measured outcomes that they're receiving based on that data. So we also, with our community supervision and some of our Department of Corrections issues as well, we also implemented some data collection and measures. We're going to be taking a really close look. With our criminal justice reform that's in the Senate today, that we passed out of the House a couple of weeks ago, and it's in the Senate now, we're also taking this Criminal Justice Reform Council, and we're setting up in statute and giving it the responsibility to be overseeing the measures that we've taken, overseeing the outcomes, and make sure that we're truly achieving the goals of criminal justice reform, holding it accountable. One of the most important parts of criminal justice reform is the implementation, making sure that you do the things you say you're going to do and you do them in the right way so you can get the right results. So we set that up in statute to be an oversight of our criminal justice reform efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, I'll say thank you from the members of this panel for taking the time to come to Oregon to share with us the work that you're doing in Georgia and the work that you're continuing to do in the future. And we're just pleased to have you here.
Thank you.
And we hope you, I know you're flying back out to tonight, but what little time you have here with us, enjoy our beautiful state. We don't have pecans, and we don't have peaches, but we do have apples and pears.
We have peaches.
Well, we don't have them like they do.
No, we don't. That's for
you
sure.
Know? And if I was still have my restaurant, I'd take you for barbecue.
Well, I appreciate so much the opportunity to come and share with you. And let me commend you all for the work that you're doing, because I know from experience that it can be difficult. And sometimes the decisions that we make are politically tough. We know it's the right decision to make, but it may not be an easy decision politically. And I just want to commend you for being willing to put the best interests of your citizens ahead of sometimes political interest in doing the right thing. And I applaud you for that. And, by the way, I do plan. My wife and I have been talking about getting out. We were hoping to work out an opportunity for her to come when I came out, but we're going to try to get out here and enjoy your beautiful state.
I do have a Senator Roblin.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you for the combination of your courage, of your convictions, and the explanations today, because I think it's important for all of us to remember why we are in these positions, mm-hmm. and what got us here. And if you aren't willing to stand up for the things that got you here, you shouldn't probably be doing it. And I think your explanation of that and your own soul-searching to decide to do this was good for all of us to listen to and hear. And we found out yesterday we have great truffles here, so maybe you can have some truffles while you're in Oregon.
Well, they had pecan truffles.
Yes, they did.
Now you're talking my language.
We'll do a trade.
That sounds good.
Oregon black and white for some pecans.
That sounds good.
There you go.
If there's no further questions, we are adjourned. Thank you.